Okay, so I guess this week we're going to be talking about issues, well, I don't know, what light quarks. And so chiral and continuum extrapolations are very important. So I struggled to put together a coherent set of thoughts, and you can judge how well I did. I want to begin with a little introduction about the general issues, followed about which extrapolations are really important. We had a good lead-in from Estia last week, which almost everyone was here for, so I can rely on it, except for Matt. Then I have some miscellaneous comments, problems, caveats, things which I've done and no one's paid any attention to, stuff like that. And then, if there's time, I can do a lead-in to what follows tomorrow in Isfan's talk, and to some extent from my talk on Thursday, with a little bit about some details of Wilson chiral perturbation theory, which might be useful if we get there. Okay. So, what are the extrapolations we're talking about? Extrapolations of interest. So, there's the SU2 case, where we want to send the light quark masses to their physical values. And by the way, today, I'll do it here actually, I'm not going to talk at all about isospin breaking or electromagnetism. We heard about that last week, so I mean that's very important. Eventually icing on the cake, but for me that's a fine detail. We're not there yet for today. So as Estia emphasized last week, the one place where we really expect to be able to use chiral perturbation theory in a detailed, reliable way is when we do the extrapolation of the light quark masses. And you know, this is something we need to do. We use SU2 left cross SU2 right chiral perturbation theory. So in case it's not obvious, that stands for chiral for me, chi for chiral. And you know, which we may or may not want to do partially quenched, and I'll talk about partial quenching as a general issue later. But you know, for the nucleons, and then separately for the excited nucleons, and then for the pions, and separately for the kaons, and separately for the eta, and so on. In this chiral perturbation theory, each of these is different. They have different coefficients. They're not related to one another, but we can make use of the expected chiral form. They exist. We just use them to fit. There's not much to be said about it. Okay, you're looking unhappy. I'm saying, okay, we've got to extrapolate. We know we've got to extrapolate. There's functional forms out there. We expect it to be a good once we get to small enough light quark masses.
Oh, so you want to extrapolate all of these to the physical?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. I mean, it's like bread and butter, obvious. Nothing to be said, really. So I'm not going to say any more about it. But we've got to get off the ground somewhere. Okay, let me move to my next point, which is, you know, is there any use to treating MU, MD, and MS as all light, which means in some sense small compared to a lambda QCD, and again depends on what you take for this, whether it's true or not. And
before you go on, already on the previous one, it's not clear, is it, for nucleons, for example, that converges for the physical ion mass. I mean, it obviously converges for mathematically small ion masses, but there's some issue about, particularly for the nucleon, because things like this delta threshold, but I really read papers about baryon power perturbation theory, I'm filled with gloom.
Well, I used to be, but there've been okay.
A friend of yours in Seattle has told you it's okay.
Well, I have gloom down the hall from me in Seattle. Okay, embodied in Martin Savage, right? Okay, it depends on the quantity. Some things are better than others, but there is a more positive view coming out of people like Meissner. And I am not actually a true expert in this. I've done some baryon stuff, but I don't really know the numbers. But looking, you know, the recent papers from Meissner are worrying about whether you can do things with pions of mass 300 and 400 MeV, not worrying about 140. So my sense is that. Yeah, right. GA, all the masses. You know, when you get to things like magnetic moments and things more complicated, then maybe it's more not so clear. I'll talk about that a little bit. So, okay, depends on the quantity. There is some uncertainty there. It's certainly true, and I will say this, that baryons are worse than mesons. But I'm not going to go through a shopping list today.
Before you go on, what's the intuitive reason for baryons? Is it just this threshold that is very passing, or is there a more general intuitive reason?
Well, there's a more general reason, which is that, you know, if you look at quantities like m pi squared, their chiral expansion is mq plus, you know, mq squared log mq. So it's in powers of mq. But if you look at the nucleon, it's some constant plus something proportional to mq plus the next term is mq to the 3 halves. And then it's mq squared log mq. And then there's mq to the 5 halves and so on. So the expansion is given by m pi over. Well, in the chiral perturbation theory, it's 4 pi f pi, which I will call today lambda chi to distinguish it from lambda QCD. So this is the expansion parameter in baryons, no square. Okay, so that's another thing. I mean, there's a threshold issue, which is, I guess, distinct from this.
But that's fine. I mean, this number is small, and different quantities are different kind of series in it. The question is, when n pi over 4 pi over f pi is smaller than, I don't know, in the theoretical world, 0.1.
How much threshold?
Can I believe the above or below? I mean, in principle, is there a reason to say that the above, the n pi squared is worse than the mm?
In principle, I mean, it's just that, you know, there are. In this expansion, each subsequent term is less suppressed than in this expansion than in this one.
What I'm asking is,
in detail?
To a quark mass in which the correction after a map, I don't count a map, okay? So the correction, the subleading correction and the chiral expansion is 20% of the leading correction. And they do the same for m pi squared. And in both cases, it should be the same amount. Do you should have the same trust in it or not? I mean, does it lie to me? Will it fool me, this mn, and make the coefficient of mq3 halves small, and then sneak up on me later on and make this number?
You know,
something because there are many quarks, you know, three, two, but.
I mean, in a way, well. In a way, there's sort of like, this is like a separate series inside.
Oh, I see what you're saying. It's a sub-series.
Yeah. And I think it just depends on the quantity. Sometimes it's big, sometimes it's not so big. So you're right. You know, this is a sort of throwaway comment. It's really the coefficients that tell you what. Yeah. And I don't know of any general statement. Okay, can I move? Yep, nope, this is good. One page will do it today.
Yeah.
Why do I have 16? Yeah.
Well.
No, it's good, yes.
even we have a very large empire, okay, I could still fit the, I mean, the MN, okay, with the formula, but just, I mean, the coefficient is different, right?
Yeah,
so the question is how small the empire should be in order that formula is applicable, or?
Well, that's the same question, and
is it the same?
More or less.
I don't know. I'm looking for something.
I mean,
simple.
No, I don't have it.
So, more than the same.
It depends on the quantity. Something like that empire is of order, 300 MeV, 250 MeV. So this is around a quarter is my rule of thumb. But
let me tell you what kind of an answer which I would have. So, Michael,
you're not supposed to ask questions. You know the answer for.
Yeah,
okay, all right.
Something like at large N, clearly the bottom is very different from the core.
Yes.
Because of that nature. So that's sort of an indication why. I don't know of an argument. I'm just telling you something. I'm looking for something which is really distinguishing the values of what you're saying now.
I don't see it. Yeah.
No, nothing like
that. Okay. Back to this point. Given that MS is not so much smaller than lambda QCD, and therefore, as I'll talk about numerically in a minute, the expansion parameter in SU3 plus SU3 is much larger than that in SU2 plus SU2, and it's not clear in many cases whether it's reliable. What's the utility of doing this at all? Should we just do this? Okay, so there are some reasons why we might want to do it. Well, the first reason is the formula exists, so why not try it? Okay, if you do it, you have more constraints.
I also teach MS of what I'm down for this. Right. Lying.
Right, so there are more constraints because you package these things together and you package these things together and you have. Why not try? There's another reason which Chesty also mentions, which is that it'll provide approximate because the expansion isn't so good, input to the continuum Chi-PT community. So they write. Okay, the non-lattice.
I thought we were not.
We are trying. No. We ultimately have in our minds doing lattice calculations and using chiral perturbation theory to guide the extrapolations. When we do that along the way, we fit various coefficients. Those coefficients are generically call them Gasser Loeb Wheeler coefficients, higher order terms, we might, out of that, get approximate numbers for those coefficients. So the Gasser-Loeb-Wheeler coefficients, L, 1 through 10 or something. Is that useful? Yes, it is useful because there's this whole edifice of phenomenology built up, which we can compare to and, in some cases, give input into. Because if
I get you.
Okay.
And you have an opinion on whether this edifice is actually reliable, convincingly.
Well, I'm an outsider for that, so I can read the papers, the review papers, 50% of which are by Binance, and some of it sounds convincing that there are places in the some places where they really have gone to two loops and seems like things are converging, but to pin things down more, they have to make estimates of certain of these coefficients and that we can give input, that's useful.
And the question was, suppose you got the coefficients, right? Somehow. You just did sense on the lattice, you can tune these parameters, you can get the coefficients in principle.
Yes.
What's the status of all this continuum, huge industry which calculates everything under the sun in terms of the L1 to L10?
Is it
convincing that it will be worth, so is it?
Well, first of all, it has to be done to two loops, that's for sure.
The loops means up to L10?
No, that means up to, there's another set of, these are the one loop coefficients.
Okay.
And then the two loops, there's a, you know, 50 more. Yeah, but in many processes, only a few of these enter, and so it's.
Do you have enough class checks?
Yeah, they do. They do. In some cases, they do. So they can make predictions at the two-loop level. Mm-hmm. But it would. Anyway, so they have basically a very complex fit to a bunch of phenomena, and you could say they output a certain number of parameters. I mean, the ones which are, I think, quite interesting are the ones which vanish as nc goes to infinity, things which involve sort of loops of quarks. And some of those, those are the ones which are very poorly determined, and which, in some sense, they have to assume are small. Those ones, maybe we can get a handle on, disconnected diagrams. So that will be an interesting check on whether that edifice is correct. So that's the sort of thing I have in mind there.
That one does need these two loop stuff. I mean, just from phenomenology, one loop is not good enough.
That's true. I mean, it depends how accurate you want to be. But
that means when you say the more constraint, you're gonna fit two loops?
No, I mean that. In the SU2 game, you do a separate fit for this guy, and so on. Yeah, in the three-flavor case, you fit more lattice numbers to fewer parameters. So there.
Parameters means one loop.
However many loops, it's still a true statement.
It does depend. I mean, it does matter.
Yeah, the lattice calculations, with two exceptions, both due to binance, m pi and f pi have now been calculated in partially quenched color perturbation theory to two loops. Apart from those two cases, we only have one loop available. Okay. I was thinking I have one loop in my mind, but I was just simply saying that if you assume that this is a good symmetry, then you have fewer parameters in your fits. Okay?
I have a little bit of a confusion because
this is really impressive. Okay, forget this lot, right? We'll just stick with this phase. Yeah.
Isn't there an exact matching you can work out when you first tweet MS as light and then you make him heavier and then the number of parameters matches? I mean, it's true that.
Yes, that's to say that you can start off in down here and then you can consider the limit where M up and down is smaller than MS, and in that way you can get relations between the SU2 cross SU2 parameters for this expansion and this expansion and this expansion. But it relies upon this. Okay, this is a subset of this. That's all it's saying.
Oh, so you have fewer parameters actually.
Yeah. So in that.
I'm living under the wrong impression that if you do the most general thing, so you with MS and you allow yourself to add enough.
No, you're right. But
if you do it with a very heavy MS, will have a good character and up and then down.
I think we're saying the same thing. I mean, you can only get anything useful out of the fact that SU2 is a subgroup of SU3 if this is a good expansion.
Sure, but the stress is on good expansion.
Yes.
Goodness.
Right. If it's not a good expansion, you have a huge number of parameters here, it feeds into a huge number here. Right. Okay. Related to this, but somehow a better reason to do this, I think, is that if you want to discuss decays, such as k to 2 pi decays or k to 3 pi decays, so let's write down 3 pi because that looks so scary, we'd never do that on the lattice. These are very hard / impossible on the lattice, but these can be related by free-flavor chiral perturbation theory to things we can do, k to pi, k to vacuum. And so by using chiral perturbation theory, we extend the reach of the lattice in an approximate way. Okay. All right. Other expansions. Obviously, we have other extrapolations. We obviously have A goes to zero. Okay, and an important question is, in what sense is this related, entangled to the chiral expansion? And that's what I'll get to. We also have to worry about this one. L goes to infinity. Okay, I don't want to say very much about that, other than, you know, there's two cases. One, like single particle matrix elements where you have e to the minus m pi L exponential effects. You can predict these in the same framework. And so anyone who does a chiral perturbation theory fit should actually do a fit with a finite volume chiral perturbation theory. It's a trivial thing to do, and that's what everyone does. So you can just include this. It's just a standard thing.
It's not quite standard. There's debates about whether adding Lucia tricks is better, and, you know, I mean, it comes in many different
Okay. Thank you, Chris. No, good point, good point. You can do better than one-loop chiral perturbation theory by Luciarizing. So, and obviously you should do what you can do. At some point you're sort of like doing a partial resummation, and it's not always clear whether that's how accurate that is, but anyway. So there are, yeah, so there are games, but relatively speaking, thank you, it's standard. Then there are the more problematic cases, which Chris talked about last week, where you have more than one particle, you have cuts, if you want, where you have power law, volume effects. Okay, I'm not going to say anything about those. This is all I've said about this, so that's it. That finite volume effects are important. We clearly need to get to big enough volumes so that we're in the regime where this applies, if this is the case. But once we're there, we use the standard technology.
At one point, you weren't clear yet, but Jacques Lecoq.
Ah.
And it sounded to me like he was saying that the criterion for how big L you have to take is not that e to the minus n pi L is not smaller than 1, but it is the criterion that, since we understand now in detail dynamically how parasymmetric breaking works on the front of the eigenvalues of the operator, of the Dirac operator, that you have to sort of make sure that you, if you think about the eigenvalues along the imaginary axis, the mass coming from the real axis, that you sort of, and the bigger you make L, the more denser they are, but the spacing between the eigenvalues goes like 1 over L to the 4th, and m pi has to be so far from this axis that when you open a 45 degree angle, you see many, many eigenvalues. So L has to be big enough. It's not a quibble about the asymptotics. It's not a mathematical quibble. But I think that in practice, do you remember? He came up with a number which was for L.
Yeah, I was never really convinced. I don't know. I mean,
okay, this is interesting.
You don't know anything about that.
I follow your words, but I've never heard this page discussion.
Minus m pi times L minus twice the radius of the pion. That's phenomenologically the sensible thing. Because you want the pion not to touch, you know, not to touch itself at the back kind of thing. That might, I half remember reading abstract of the paper. Did you ever make that
No, that, yeah, no, this,
yeah,
that was from, different.
From very different arguments, but I mean.
Okay, what he said was not phrased in physical terms, it was phrased basically in the statement that the reason you have a non-zero psi bar psi is that you have sort of a spectrum of D, which is one-dimensional rigid, designed by this space by something which goes like 1 over L to the 4th. And your mass, if your mass is so close that it sees that granularity, then the volume is just not big enough. I mean, you really are seeing something totally different than what you would want to see. It's a very different. You see, this is an argument that you can make independent of the ultraviolet completion of the theory, right? This is an argument which is just Carol Lagrangian argument. That argument uses the fact that we know that it comes from a Dirac operator. This argument would be true even if there were no Dirac operator in the background.
That's, yes, I don't know anything about that. That's.
But it's very worrisome. I mean, the number was pretty. What was it? No, nobody was here. Am I missing?
Yeah, I remember that. It was big. It was disturbingly big.
Yeah, it was not like.
Four or five eigenvalues that were not distorted by the finite alignment test.
Yeah. And
you got what conclusion out of it?
Oh, yeah, I don't know. You needed. Fermi side or something.
For what?
What he was coming
for
about,
realistic
physical biomass about, I think, four.
I can work it out.
So it was not, so the finally physical biomass, the number was not much larger than what we get out of this.
Right.
I think it was more deviation if there was not such a small biomass, so to say. There was more deviation than the quark mass was
right.
Coming
out. Okay, we will try to
Is this something written down? Is this written down? No. But I mean, is there a paper about this?
Oh, I don't know.
Okay. Well, very interesting. Anyway, I'm not going to talk about it. Yeah, I have a short list there. Okay, the last thing that I may or may not talk about at this rate is So partial quenching. This is valence, or in general, this is a particular case of the. Of when you do what is called mixed action. So you have a different valence action from your C action. Maybe domain wall valence versus staggered C, or even domain wall superimproved versus ancient domain wall C that you happen to have because you wanted to build up a big set of configurations. And so this just means action C, S.
Valence
and, SC does not equal S valence.
Oh, my age shows because for me mixed action.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Go ahead, Carol.
Okay. Okay.
This is a bit misleading because there is no action.
Okay. I am using the colloquial term for this.
You can say
hazy action.
You can say hybrid action,
okay.
Not quantum field.
No,
funky action.
Hybrid, okay. Non-action. Okay?
No
okay.
No action.
Okay, I'll just call this generically partial quenching, just to have a name. And so the issue really here is this useful? When you go off the real axis into this non-quantum field theory land, do you gain extra knobs to turn which help you, or do you just kid yourself? Okay, so today I won't talk about quenching. I won't even write it down. Don't write the word down. Partial quenching, which is a terrible term. It should be partial unquenching, of course. But anyway, and then there's an interesting thing about the so-called epsilon regime, where you make the box really small so that these pion effects are not suppressed. That's interesting. There you totally rely on chiral perturbation theory. I mean, this goes back to some stuff. You read one of the first suggestions of this. Is this useful? I mean, I don't know, but I don't want to talk about it because I don't know anything about it. And then there's another little mini industry starting up, which is to use twisted boundary conditions, not twisted mass. That's different. But twisted boundary conditions. I guess we heard something about that last week.
Yeah.
And you can incorporate that into chiral perturbation theory. Okay. I agree with your final position.
Okay.
For anyone else who can remember, I remember what you said.
Yes.
Okay. So the question is whether it makes sense to partially quench twisted boundary conditions. Anyway, I won't talk about it. okay. so that's the stage. Let's just do some numbers, just for fun. Maybe I can do it here. All right, so let's have two axes. Along this one, let's put m pi over lambda chi squared. So that's our chiral expansion parameter. And down here, we're going to put our continuum expansion parameter. I'll just call it A. Okay, so let's put some points on here, being sort of naive. Oh, by the way, so... I'll get to that in a minute. Yeah, okay. So lambda chi is, well, what? Two choices. 4 pi, f pi. This has to be the 93 one. That's the one which the 4 pi comes with. So this is 1200 MeV. Or let's be more cautious and say 800 MeV, just to get a range of numbers. Those are two possible values you might take. So let's see. Here's the kaon. If I use the upper number, I get 0.17. If I use the lower number, I get 0.4. So this mk over lambda chi squared. So if this were the expansion parameter, then this would be 0.17.
This f by the 93 is at non-zero. 86
at 0. Yeah, okay. Fine.
So that gives you another bit
of the decrease. Okay. Okay. Glad to keep us honest. So then, let's see where we're headed. Down here is the pi physical, and you put the numbers in, this is 0.14 or 0.03. This is obviously a fixed factor between these two. Sorry. Okay. And then where are we? Well, we're, you know, staggering down this way. Literally. And so we go down to pi milk. Okay. Well, I randomly took 250 or 300 MeV, depending on the time of day. But I think with 300 MeV, so this is, I used here, this is 0.06, and this is 0.14. Anyway. So we're trying to get down to here. You know, obviously, here the expansion parameter. It's nice and small. Here it's, say, a tenth. It's looking pretty good. If you go, that means, so we're including the, always we're including the next leading order. So we have 1 plus a tenth. We're leaving out the hundredth, say. Well, that sounds pretty good, and we're extrapolating, so, yeah. All right. Now, in the A side, here's some more numbers, different color. Okay, to roughly match, I should put it down here. So this is, so this was in quotes because I haven't really told you what it is, but this is A lambda QCD equals 0.15 if I take A inverse is 2GV, typical value, and here lambda QCD is 300 MeV. Whether this correctly represents discretization errors, it's not clear, but it's an estimate. And then this is unimproved Wilson, for example. If we do use an improved action, then we get to square this. So we're down here. A lambda QCD squared, which is about 0.02. Right? So, we're extrapolating this way, and we're extrapolating this way. what do we learn from this picture? Well, first of all, if you did Wilson, nothing, no improvement or anything, old days, then you have typically MQ over order A. You've got to treat these things as equally important problems in some sense. This is about as far away from here as this is from here. Because with Wilson, also, you can't get so light. Okay?
I don't know how serious I should take the fact that the grid is a sort of equally important. I mean, if I take equal grids in both directions.
So. I'm just saying this parameter is about the same as this parameter.
Yeah, I understand that comes out from you know, taking number two CB.
I think this is, yeah, okay. There's the slop here, but I want to just guide us to how to think about things. I mean, so at this level, if you want to address the question of which is more important, you'd say they're roughly speaking equally important. There's a starting point, and then you go and see. Okay, he doesn't like that. All right, let me go over here so I don't have to bend down too much.
This is A inverse, right? MQ.
Okay.
Or
so from now on, in these expressions, factors of lambda, QCD, lambda chiral, and all those things are implicit.
I tell you what bothers me. It bothers me because there's a presumption here that sort of in the middle of that point, I put my finger somewhere in the middle. Okay, I have both finite cutoff and finite bulk mass. And sort of I have a vision that this is sort of equally distant from a continuum and a chirally symmetric. While I know that all the chiral Lagrangian, actually, there's a better word, all the chiral Lagrangian technique rigorously applies at finite A, if you have the symmetry exact, which is sort of lost in all of this. The fact that you could sit and draw lines parallel to that horizontal line anywhere you wanted and still have, you know, the same ordering, maybe one more L. Sort of not used, not exploited, lost.
Well, okay.
It's sort of saying that a single point of interest is that corner, which is fine, but you're not using something. You understand? I mean,
I think I'm going to get somewhere where you will hopefully be happier. I'm trying to. So the punchline is that in general you need to do exactly what you said. Incorporate the order A effects in the chiral expansion.
No, but it's a question of order. Okay, the best world, what I would like to see. Okay.
Yes.
Is somebody sitting there, zero quark mass exactly on the lattice. Do your chiral Lagrangian technique. Get all the L's and extract your. Transform it into a dimensionful parameter after you take all into account all the logs, whatever. Then you have the lambdas of that are hidden inside the L's. Plot them as a function, multiply them by A, take A to zero, show me a plot that they go to finite limits. And then I know I have not mixed two things up.
Okay.
And the fact that that exists, that option exists in principle, is sort of not used. It could be that that option didn't exist. It could be that for some logical reason that we are missing, that it's not doesn't hold, it is the Carl Lagrangian only applies in the continuum. What I'm stressing is that Carl Lagrangian logic has nothing to do with a local field theory anything.
I totally agree. But
we are not exploiting that.
Well, we're going. Oh, okay. Hopefully, we're going to if we get there. But that yeah. No. It's good. Good. I mean, I'm trying to get people to think about this. But I'm really at a much more naive, basic level. I'm just saying you've got to think about this numerically. These discretization effects are, crudely speaking, as important as quark mass effects. You know, plus or minus values of lambda QCD. But I want to say, well, let's think about different actions. Okay, so let's say instead of unimproved Wilson, we used improved Wilson, or domain ball slash overlap. There, we would expect our discretization errors to be governed by this number, okay? In which case, for most of what we do, we don't, they're much small, that's a much smaller effect than the quark mass effects. And the power counting, which looks right, is the quark mass So what I'm saying is that the a squared errors, which are the size of the errors, again, doing it without any lambdas in to make them dimensional, so smaller than the quark mass errors, unless we get to the physical masses, then we have they're roughly comparable. I'm just saying what's on that picture. Maybe I should just carry on and you won't fight with me for the moment, because you have to see where this is going.
But I take exception at the way of looking at exactly parallel things. It's not just an approximation, that's all.
Fair enough. Okay. However, you would think that improved staggered should be in this list, okay? Because they have a squared errors. But in practice, this number gets multiplied by a big factor because it's not right to use lambda QCD. You have to use a number like 1 GV in practice. And it turns out that a squared effects are roughly speaking of the same size as MQ effects. That is based on data. This is not something you would have known a priori.
This because
I don't know.
It was always A is really twice what you think it is.
Yeah, right. Right. That's one way. But it's even worse than that. If you actually, I mean, it's worse in that this is really alpha S A squared. So the splittings, I mean, where does this come from? This comes from plots like you've seen these plots. If you plot m pi squared against mq, you have something which looks like this for the different tastes of staggered. This is the gold stone, and then there are these other non-gold stones. Okay, I've exaggerated things, but let's go out here. So, the place where milk runs down to is, say, somewhere, roughly speaking, like here. So this is corresponds to m pi of order 250 to 300 MeV. And at this point, these splittings, which are a squared effects, each of these, are comparable in size to the actual value of the pion mass. Okay. That is, so this is where the data stops. This is just extrapolating. And so that's what I mean by this.
That's improved on?
Improved. If I did unimproved, then this would be up to the row. Okay. even after improvement, it's just a fact. This is the sort of the weakness of staggered for mesons, that there is this, these effects are big. Now, on the other hand, they appear to be systematically controllable, as we saw with Andreas and he talked last week. And in heavy light, things are a lot better, as you'll hear next week, I guess.
What's Hopkins principle for improving it further?
People don't improve staggered aspects without
any case to tell. Yeah, but to really do it, to, you know.
It's obvious to me that you can calculate these, but just explore a bigger set of improvements. Maybe you'll find out. I mean, you're always making choices when you improve what you're adding.
Right. This is
the final arm, which the a squared terms are not that bad.
You need the four fermion terms.
You need four fermion terms.
I mean, it appears. Mm. And then that's a total mess. I mean, there has been some work in that.
Do they come in with bad signs?
Some of them do. Some of them do have bad signs.
Come with bad signs.
Yeah. I mean, it's just awfully complicated too, and there's a lot of them. I don't know. So, I mean.
No, what do you think? I mean, the cyber stuff is cheap. No, I mean, it's actually not cheap. No?
Yes, I guess it's doable, but. This is where we are now. Okay. All right. 2 pages down. Okay. No, 3 actually, because I already said one other thing. Okay. Okay. The general message is we need to think about how do these two limits we want to take react with one another, and we'll get to your Kara-Ogonchian in a finite A short at some point. But there's something I want to say before that, just as a warning. We've already covered this a little bit, but not everything has such nice chiral expansion. Some things are more infrared sensitive. We should just remember that always. So if we look at the charge radius of the pion, say, and what does its chiral expansion look like? Okay, it begins at next to leading order. That's the thing. There's no leading order contribution. And so what it looks like is okay. There's no m factors of m protecting the log. It just diverges in the chiral limit.
So the lastest quark has an infinite.
Right. It's just because there's a pion cloud. You can put the current here, and this can get spread out as you want. It's physics. Yeah. There's nothing. It's just I just want to remind ourselves that. Okay.
Was some continuum papers, all this, some estimation stuff, right below some, not low, but some old potential scattering estimation technique supposedly solved, but nothing. I have some vague memory.
Oh, I'm not sure. I mean, in actual fact, for the physical case, this is not that big if you put in a reasonable scale underlying it. So it's not really, it's just that this will mean enhanced finite volume effects for one thing. Okay, fine. Another page down. Good. All right. So there's a lot of work going on in this partially quenched theory. So let's talk about that a little bit. You know, first of all, okay, I should probably just say a word about why. Okay, so why do we partially quench in this most general sense? Okay, first of all, it's just cheap to reduce the valence mass. So MV now stands for M valence. So it's an easy knob to turn. Why not do it and see what we find? We make things more chiral, you might think. In some sense, we do. In what sense? There's other reasons. We can avoid certain contractions, Wick contractions, or at least consider different contractions separately. For example, if you consider, as we'll hear more about this later this week, twisted mass, QCD, or you consider isospin broken QCD, or QCD in the background of electromagnetism, and you look at the pi zero correlation function, then there's a connected and a disconnected contribution, right? And field theory tells us to add these two together, but we can do whatever we want, and we can calculate this separately from this. I mean, just similarly, as Chris was talking about. Okay, we can use partial quenching to actually come up with a separate prediction for this and this. And in fact, that gives you a window on some of these gasoline wheeler parameters.
this stupid question. Do they really be normalized and dependent for these guys?
You mean like the z factors on the end here? Because here you have
to. Well, I calculate the 2-point function psi bar gamma 5 psi of x times psi bar gamma 5 psi of y. I know that. I mean, brainwashed to believe that this thing has a continuum limit. I put z's and then we'll have a continuum limit. But now you're splitting it up into two pieces.
In function grants, there's no spectrum, right? I mean, you're asking a question that can't be answered.
No.
He's
dipoles and all kinds of crap in partial quench.
No, it's not partial quench yet.
Well,
at the moment it's just two different drawings, and I'm asking whether each drawing.
No, they have to.
Functional integral.
They have. You have to
modify. Continuum limit, independent, or just the sum has a.
Well, I think that's an unknown question.
Unknown answer.
Yeah, I mean, that's a question of whether the partially quenched.
The top diagram is the pi plus, and then the sum is the, final. So each separately.
Oh, so you're just proving it.
Not in these cases. Not in these cases.
Right.
For pions, it's easy because in the QCD, that's absent if NLP equals M down.
Pi plus is the top one only, and each is a physical particle, no problem.
But in the general case,
it's tricky.
No, in the general case.
The general case, this is absent for the pi zero.
Oh, okay.
But, so, I mean, that's one of the. Okay, yeah. But making certain assumptions, you can predict independent results for these two. And for example, if you could calculate this guy in the case of m up equals m down, according to partially quenched chiral perturbation theory, this correlator should be proportional to at large time t. That's a double pole, e to the minus m pi t, times something which is proportional to m up minus m down squared, times Gasser Lloyd Wheeler's L7. And this is, in fact, the. One of the violations of the Dashen theorem. So the similar thing holds true for SU3 as well. If you calculate this guy separately, then the coefficient tells you something about some of these L's, if you believe partially quenched chiral perturbation theory.
Now, suppose I don't want to do that, but suppose I want to do 1 over NC. If I declare that the continuum limit is sort of order by order in 1 over NC also holds, wouldn't I get an answer in the affirmative that these two things do the normal answer hold? Just one, because they have different powers of NC, and I say that the continuum limit can be taken uniformly in NC, and therefore I can expand it on NC.
So they would renormalize separately, you're saying?
So it would be kosher to speak about a separately continuum quantities, even without appealing to any non-field theory.
Maybe that's interesting to think about. I'm not sure about that, but okay. All right.
I agree with what you point. Just that in a different line. In the second line, if you replace the pi with a singlet, would that change your line?
The problem is that n equals infinity is a bit degenerate. You expand around the degenerate point.
No, so forget about n equals infinity.
Back to this.
Yeah.
What was your point? Sorry, I got distracted.
You replace the second one, you replace the pions with singlets.
Yes.
If that didn't change the way the diagram is normalized, then that would be another argument that they're normalized separately.
Well, I do think that there is a different renormalization. The short distance part of that will have, there'll be disconnected diagrams. At least, depends which operator you put here, but I think for the pseudoscalar, you would get a non-zero contribution from disconnected even at short distance.
Yeah.
Which in principle you could calculate. All right. So Okay, so that's another, that's one potential use of partial quenching. But I think it's important to remember that, as we saw last week from Andreas, it's very important in practice for the milk calculations of n pi squared, f pi squared, n k squared, f k, and then the calculations that we heard last week of fd, and calculations you'll hear next week about fb and related things. This extra knob to doing m valence separately from m c gives you, allows you, if you believe chiral perturbation theory, to constrain the parameters quite significantly better. So I guess the question is it correct? Are you kidding yourself? So, well, that's my question for you. I don't know the answer.
The theory is a field theory. It's a field theory of the C-course. What you're doing is you're probing it, and the probe is non-local. So the question is whether the non-local effects of these probes are giving you the wrong physics, the hot physics.
Yeah, but a normal probe may end up being on the normalized.
You work with some cutoff in the theory, and you measure the physics of things with a probe which is not normal. So you're going to have correlations at long distances that are not physics.
Right.
And are they bigger or are they smaller than the?
Right. Well, no. It's in my mind, there's certainly not physics in this theory. I mean, there are double poles, blah, blah, blah. The question is whether you can correctly describe that new physics using partially quenched chiral perturbation theory, which is this useful depends upon the existence of partially quenched chiral perturbation theory. Without this, you can't make use of this.
Okay. If you did it at a finite cutoff, then the issue of the vulnerability no longer arises.
Never.
But the entire numerical procedure based on partial quenched chiral perturbation still can apply, because you just have another effective Lagrangian whose parameters you are after, and you are going to use any trick you have in the book to do it.
So the big question, is it correct to write down, for example, a local L effective chiral? The argument for that you have for a kosher field theory is that that's the only way you're going to get cluster decomposition out of your resulting effective field theory, which you know you must have because your underlying theory has it. But that's not the case here, the underlying theory being partially quenched. You can write it in terms of ghosts.
Well,
so you know it's not physical. So what is the argument you have for the
underlying? Always
a finite day, yes.
At finite day, you're not messing around with anything.
No.
That's what you're going to do after you're finished.
Right, okay. So.
How do you really need unitarity and locality for chiral effective Lagrangian?
Well, why do you write down? I mean, in some sense.
It's not the Hamiltonian, it's not the Hermitian. I write a set of cues which are generating, you know, the ghost symmetry, and you get this graded symmetry. They do commute with H. If I arrange the double symmetry.
No vacuum, no problem.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know the answer to this, but I think there's someone.
To probe this,
yeah.
It looks to me that what I want to say is that the chances for it to be right at finite day are much higher, but the chances for it to be being right when you also combine with an A goes to zero.
Interesting. I'm personally not so worried about the A goes to zero. Because you can study the theory perturbatively and then you understand it fine. Okay.
E to the minus one of the least squared effect at the end of the day,
Okay, well, I can't argue about that. That we can, yeah. That we can go to real fight about, yeah, never get to any conclusion. Okay. So, I don't know the answer to this, but this is the assumption that underlies all this work. That's all I want to bring out. Because, I mean, this is very nice theory. You know, it correctly, I don't know what the right word is, produces or reproduces the expected unphysical properties. So it's a really nice sentence I put together there. You know, such as if you look at disconnected guys, you get double poles. By the way, and not higher. That's something you can show with fairly minimal assumptions. You only get double poles, no single and double. And, well, from what we know, that matches what we have seen in the data. And, you know, at the level of pitchers, if you think about what partial quenching does, it certainly just, the pions which appear in the loop are only those where there's a C running around here. You have C plus valence plus ghosts, and these guys just cancel. So it matches diagrammatically to what you want. So, that's the good news. So the hope is that partial quench-color perturbation theory itself, an unphysical theory, reproduces the unphysical nature of the underlying partially quenched theory. That's the assumption. Okay. Wow. Rushing through. Okay. How are we doing on time?
Ghosts.
Okay, so what do you... No, actually, I had a whole page which basically boiled down to saying advertising the fact that you can get L7 out of a direct calculation of this, which is in a paper by Shoresh and I. And I was really wanted to advertise it to Chris, who calculates these things all the time.
Yeah.
But, okay.
That is actually true.
Okay. Okay, fantastic. All right, so let's skip that then. And so I want to talk a bit about this issue we were arguing about here.
What's that? Can you write the form of the L7 dot so I have something?
Yeah, okay, sorry. Okay, so
the kind of the issue.
You want to know what the L7 term looks like? Okay, L7. A chi sigma beta minus sigma chi beta squared. It's the thing which contributes to the eta. And so, yeah. Or in the case of Eisenstein breaking to mu minus md squared terms to m. Okay?
Oh, so that was the term of the
diagonals. Yeah, that was the.
I'm asking about this. Okay.
Right. Okay. So.
So L7 is small or some size? Oh, so L7 is normal size or a bit to the other aircraft?
I don't think we have a very good idea of what L7 is. Right. That's why I thought it was interesting.
You don't know?
No. I'm not sure what I've done is enough to get better.
Right, but for the eta, it's...
But I'm asking about the
result. Yeah. Right, so this is one of these interesting ones which we'd the continuum color perturbation theory guys have very little handle on. So...
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Which basically means that if you look at the other papers, you will have L7 between 200 and... The gamma, the copy of gamma between 200 and 3G.
Something like that, yeah. I don't remember off the top. Yeah. Okay.
The sign of it as well?
I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. So let's talk about combined chiral and continuum expansions. So doing what Herbert was saying we must do, and which people have done, namely incorporate the discretization effects and their symmetries systematically into the chiral Lagrangian. You don't like what I've written here?
What I said was this, I prefer to take the chiral, do the chiral expansion at finite A and do the A expansion only on the errors that you have at finite A, not do it together. That's
okay. Well, let me
write. Would be safer because you have you're using an extra bit of information, which is that the chiral Lagrangian works also at finite A, which you're not using here.
Well, I'm certainly going to be using it here.
No, you're using the double expansion, so it is enough for it to work at A equals 0 and MQ equals 0. I'm saying that it works at A equals non-zero and MQ equals 0.
In practice, I'm using what you want me to use. I mean, I imagine fitting some data at non-zero A.
Yeah.
I'm relying on the fact that I can write down a chiral Lagrangian to describe the theory at non-zero A.
In practice, in a utopical practice, first take MQ to zero and then extract the L's of the function of A. Then do another extrapolation, not a simultaneous extrapolation. That's
not what I'm saying. Steve's going to be putting in these C2 kind of terms, which will not be there with your kind of action. So, but he's trying to go beyond that. He's in addition, into the chiral Lagrangian, put some of the terms which.
Yeah, no, there is a small difference.
I'm not sure whether I am or I'm not going to be doing something consistent with what you're saying. So let me just proceed. So let's just write down, without going into any details, let's just write down some formulae for, and to the extent possible, I'll just keep everything partially quenched as well. We can always take the unquenched limit, so it's just to get the sense of how things go. So we look at a valence pion, charge pion, disconnected, connected contributions only. And it's proportional to the valence mass. And what does it look like? Some constant, and then schematically, it looks like this. Okay. For whatever reason, I wrote down the staggered one. Okay, that'll do. Plus, of course, higher orders. And, well, maybe I will write down separately. If I put a scale in here, a common scale. Dimensions are always made up by appropriate factors of lambda. Don't worry about that. So what this formula is supposed to say is that there are chiral logarithms here, which in general will have a squareds in, because this is basically the particle mass. It's some pion squared over a scale, and that has corrections which are of order a squared. And in the staggered case, those are as large as the quark mass terms, so you've got to keep them there. The coefficient can have C, valence or a squared, and then in addition there's analytic terms. This basically amounts to saying that the lambda scale associated with each of these three is different. But I'd written a common one there, so I wrote this outside. Okay. And so this is the result of doing a chiral Lagrangian analysis, including the discretization effects. Now, I have done an expansion in the sense that sorry, no. So the point is that these, in general, are non-Goldstone masses.
So Q is not a Gaussian mode, so B0 does depend on A then somehow.
Right. So B0 depends on A as in this here. Okay. I'm sorry. I apologize. I didn't write down the right formula. This is the gold star. Excuse me.
There must be some limit where that becomes massive.
Yes, when M and A goes to
zero, I get B zero. That's not zero. Okay. Is M
squared? It's over M valence.
Well, that's the valence. That's not the mass of
the
vector.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Sorry. Okay.
Okay. No. I'm sorry. I've forgotten what I've written this down for. I mean, I just simplified things. This is the Goldstone pion. This is the one with the symmetry.
Yeah.
Its mass vanishes when the valence mass goes to zero.
That's fine.
Good.
I thought you said that.
I'm not looking, Jack. Because the sum of notation is with a 2, no?
No.
Yes, it probably is. Fine. Okay.
The B that typically people call it as B.
Fine. Yes. 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 What?
This B can be as big as 4 GeV.
Yes, this is the big number, the big scale.
So 2 times it is even bigger, so it's an impressive number.
Fair enough. Okay. So, so this is this loop. Let's just redraw the diagrams. You have contributions. I'm actually slightly confused by something standing here, but contributions like this. You have contributions like this. And these are, in fact, what happens is these largely cancel, and this is the ones which are dominant. That's why there's a valence in there. But this is the not the Goldstone pion. It's the taste singlet, and so this can exist. Blah blah blah. That's why this, in general, has an A squared. Okay. So what do I write this down? I want to think about, you know, how these, do these limits commute. And how smooth the limits. So if we take this expression, okay. The other thing is, this a squared here really has alpha s squared of a in plus alpha s cubed or whatever. So to say that it's not just a squared, I can't really fit it as just a squared. That would be a wrong thing to do. It has a logarithmic dependence too. So there's an implicit logarithmic dependence in here, and then there's an explicit one here. Yes.
The upper diagram, the diagonal in principle doesn't have to be the single equation.
That is true. I'm confused about this. Let's ignore this for a moment.
Okay. All right.
The extrapolation in A goes to zero, what I want to say is non-trivial, because it has this log in here. And also in here, but it, in particular, it has in here. And in practice, as you saw from that graph I showed you earlier, I have just finished answering. These two terms are comparable in size.
What you were saying is that in front of the A-squared in the argument of the log, there's also an alpha, or not?
Yes, there is. Yeah. But I'm not saying that. I'm saying here's a log, and it's got an A-squared. Okay, so yes, there is an alpha squared here, too. Relatively speaking, this is the bigger effect. So this seems to me to be a reason why you want to have this machinery, because then you, I mean, the thing which appears in this loop is actually something you can measure. So you can put, from data, you can put this dependence in. So then you can do a self-consistent fit, which is what the milk guys do. Okay.
Calculate the
pion
bubbles, and if you measure the
pion
mass, you can calculate the bubbles.
Right. Thank you. I agree. That's what I was saying. You know the mass to put in the logarithm. Blah, 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 blah. What else did I want to say? I'm getting confused here. One thing you might say against including order A squared effects in current perturbation theory is it really just very simple? Do we just take each parameter, like B0 here, and it gets an A squared correction like this one here, and F, F will have a different one, and every new thing will have a different one. So do we learn anything by doing this other than doing something naive? I mean, more naive, just extrapolate and assume everything has some dependence on A. So that's why that's where these terms are the answer. These are non-trivial terms, which we have to include, and they are not given simply by adding a straightforward A dependence or A squared dependence. And furthermore, the coefficient in front of this term is predicted in terms of other things you can measure.
You said two things. One is that it is less general, the other is a small general. So in the sense that if I put any A squared dependence in the coefficients of the Carroll Lagrangian, I will never get this log. You're saying I cannot make it so that I get a log like that.
Let's think about it. No. So in Chiral, let's think, in Chiral perturbation theory and the continuum we'd have, let's just forget about valence and C. So we have this plus this, and okay, let's write this out. This is n pi squared over 4 pi f squared with some number, 1/3, in fact, plus some L's times n quark. And so we write this as 1 plus a squared. This is, m pi squared also, which is the same thing, okay? But like that, I'm going to have it down here, so it doesn't gain anything to write it up there.
Inside the log.
But that's 1 plus a squared. Now you're confusing me standing here.
All right, that's not fine.
Well, it's not that I don't want to go. I just can't stand on my feet and think it out. My gut feeling is, okay, maybe you get the same form, but you wouldn't have the... There's something non-trivial in here in that there are relations between the coefficients here,
right,
which are absent. Fair enough.
The fact that there are relations, so the basic claim is, to boil it down, is that if you didn't know that it comes from QCD, you would have more of the A coefficients, and you are somehow using the fact that it comes from QCD to be related.
Okay, thank you. You've clarified myself thinking, yes, good. That's the main point. The other point may be right, may be wrong, but it doesn't matter. Okay. So this is why we should do this. Okay? And another reason why we should do this is that when we get down to quark masses, which, are very small, comparable, it turns out, always to A squared, then the alignment of the vacuum depends upon a competition between those two terms. And if we want the vacuum to be not receive very large discretization errors, we have to understand that. Okay. Okay. And this, goes into the whole business of Aoki phases, and we'll hear more about that tomorrow and later in the week. Yeah. And then, later in the weekend. Okay. But there was some discussion about order of limits last week.
Yeah.
So maybe we can do a bit on that.
Okay, but my gut feeling is that after I've sharpened your statement, that's what I don't believe. I don't believe, I'm suspicious of what don't believe is a good sound as I know how to prove that it's not, or something like that. But what I find suspicious is the claim that you can calculate relations between the unknown. So I have one way of doing it. It would stay at fixed A,
get your effective blood balance. Then you think mentally about this L1 to, there's more L's now because it's less
right. There's three more L's.
L's. Yeah, L1's waiting for us. And you think about all these L's as functions of A. And the sharp question is, can you calculate relationships between them, knowing that this effective Lagrangian comes from QCD? And that's why it's kind of suspicious that you can claim that you can calculate relationships. Now, the point that the limit A goes to zero because of asymptotic freedom, we know some stuff about it, is well taken. It's not like I'm not aware. Still, I feel that it will be so, that it's possible for it to be so contaminated by non-perturbative stuff that it's actually incalculable. That's my worry or suspicion or whatever adjective makes it more palatable. But that's where I come from.
Yeah,
you wouldn't mind to use this framework if you fix A and just change the formulas for both valence and C.
Yeah, that's a separate question which I'm sympathetic to the arguments both at the level of line diagrams and its formalization by ghosts, which I could imagine. I'm not scared, okay? I'm not scared of people saying, oh, you're dropped unitarity. So what? Not every age that I find this Hermitian, that doesn't mean that I can diagonalize it yet. I'm not scared by non-local. It's a Kyle Lagrangian. I know that Kyle Lagrangians come out from string theories, which are non-local. So there are lots of things that people throw at it, which don't immediately make me tremble with fear. But that's a separate question. Basically, it's just at this point that I have sort of the major suspicion.
So to say, it's a separate question because, so to say, you do this at 1A and then somebody goes for a 10 times smaller A and then he does it again. And then the question is, so to say, the parameters coming out, are they the same, for instance?
Right.
The question is whether there are relations between the LAs in the two Ks that can be calculated just using perturbation.
And
Steve says yes, and I am suspicious. Right? That's basically the. It's correct that you say yes.
I'm not sure. Now that you. I may have been answering a different question. Perturbation theory as in QCD perturbation?
QCD, right.
I don't see it. I wouldn't say that. That you're saying that L as a function of A.
Well, didn't you say that you have a relation between. I have unknown functions, L1 to L10. Well, 13 of A, and you tell me that you can write, I don't know, L7 minus L8 plus L9, whatever, is a function of A, which is 0 at order A squared because of perturbative value, or something like that. Is that correct?
No, that's what wasn't what I had in my mind.
No, but isn't that what comes out from the way you're writing?
No, I mean, what comes out is that, you know, in addition to the L1 through L10, you have a bunch of other terms. In the Wilson case, which is the easier to write down, you would have terms which look like this. Which is an order A correction to L5 or something in the form you say. And then you have a term which is just sigma plus sigma dagger A squared some other W. That's the term, that's what I, in some other paper, got called C2. That's what Mike was referring to earlier, squared. So some of these parameters can be absorbed into the L's in the way you're suggesting. But there's only three of these. One which looks like this, and the other one is sigma plus sigma dagger, d sigma dagger, A with some W tilde. And there's a lot more L's, so I've not thought about it in the way you're talking. But then you get this guy, which is just new.
Since you have only three, and you
but I have a lot of quantities I can write down, and the order A corrections in them, you know, are given in terms of these parameters. Well, the order A ones are given in just in terms of these ones.
Yeah,
and
I don't want to drag the discussion.
No, but it's an important point.
Oh, okay, good.
No, I mean,
there's agreement that we spent time.
Well, I don't know, for me and you maybe.
Okay.
I mean, a criticism which you can throw at this whole edifice of order of color perturbation theory, including order A, is, you know, is it necessary?
No, that's another level. I'm speaking just from, I don't know whether there is something you don't agree with what I'm saying.
Okay.
So I stay at fixed A, just guided by symmetry principles of the lattice Lagrangian, I write down the Kyle Lagrangian.
Right.
Just the fact that I'm expanding in derivatives there, and I use p squared of order n cubed,
right,
restricts that makes it a finite number of terms.
Right.
I write down all of these terms.
Right. So the
all of them have also dependence on a because of v g whatever the coupling the gauge coupling constant.
Right.
Now the question is, I had the impression that you are using perturbation theory to make some restrictions on these L's of the function of G squared.
No.
Okay.
No.
Yeah. Because you, when you write L7 there, it's assumed to be independent of A or whatever, right? So you're therefore predicting your 10, your 11, 12, how many parameters there are, there's 11, I suppose. In terms, you're predicting their A dependence up to order A squared or something.
Okay.
Parameters, whereas in Herbert's case, they'd all be completely free.
Okay, yes, now, right, thank you. So what I'm imagining doing in practice is actually, because of the size of the parameters, some expansion. In the Wilson case, it would be a joint expansion, like so. So I worked in next to leading order, and I have mq squared, amq, and a squared, but not a mq squared, okay, et cetera. So if I do that, then these are the only terms I get which are additional.
So I would be missing the fact that you crossed out.
Right. So that's where my relations come from. Thank you. Thank you, Chris. Yeah. It's nothing to do with perturbation theory. That was.
It's just power.
So that's just a question of size of parameters.
Small. If somebody could solve exactly all these theories, you could answer what is why. Without, regardless, it's an analytic question. Could be phrased.
Okay. I don't know the answer.
No, but you agree that it could be phrased as an analytic question.
I'm not sure that I understand well enough to answer your question, and I think maybe we should stop talking about it right now. Okay. Maybe this is a time to stop. Yeah. I mean, people have done a whole bunch of calculations in this framework up to next and leading order in Wilson and staggered and twisted mass and blah, blah, blah. So, and I think certainly, yeah. And so it's proved useful in practice. This stuff is interesting and relevant, and we'll hear more about that later on this week. So I don't want to talk about that now. I do want to say something about this order of limits things, because I think there's potentially some misconception. If you had a term which was sitting in here, which was a squared log m valence, say, then you might be worried, because if you send a to zero first, it goes to zero. If you send m valence to zero, it blows up. Now, this is in a slightly funny ratio. It's not a physical quantity directly, but you can imagine physical quantities where this might appear, like the pseudoscalar matrix element of the pion might have a term like this. So it's interesting to know whether it does exist. And there's a paper by Claude which argues, and I believe it, that it does not exist in staggered chiral perturbation theory. You always have an A squared there.
Because it's never the goal
if there is a Goldstone bion in the loop, then that has continuum-like couplings, and you have a factor of M outside. That's basically his argument. So you have some diagram. You know, these types of things come from various places. One of them is that there are these vertices proportional to a squared, and then you just get a log m pi squared. But this is a non-Goldstone always, because the Goldstone doesn't have this vertex. So that leads always to a squared log mv plus a squared. If you have some loop with a Goldstone, then it's, because of the axial symmetry, its couplings here are either proportional to m or to p squared. And they're always continuum-like. You never get an a squared out front.
The only matchless pion has got sensible couplings.
Exactly. No, precisely. So there's no problem there. But in...
Wait, but that would be cool. What do you mean, the fact that it's diagonal? I mean...
The fact that the non-Goldstone pion, which has these unphysical couplings to other pions, is always has a mass...
All right. It's a more general statement. It's just two instead. But in any situation in which you're breaking the chiral symmetry by all the a squared terms, and you're sure you're doing that, this would be true.
No, absolutely not. No.
I guess
so. Yeah. What? For example, in Wilson.
Okay.
So Aoki showed that in the Wilson case, you get terms like n pi squared over mq 1 plus a squared log m. Okay, calling it v, let's call it v. Well, now let's forget about partial quenching. That's not relevant for this point. So you do get these terms. And that's because you violate chiral symmetry. And so your particle, which goes massless, can couple in an unphysical way. Now, on the other hand, there's an MQ here, so if you pull this on the other side, this doesn't blow up for a physical quantity. And
no,
I
understand that this is a problem.
Right. It's but anyway.
You have the MQ
now. Right. So it's it's just an observation about the nature of these terms. And then, well, Taku is working on the issue of if you have a hybrid theory, so you have a different valence and C, then you do get in these loops the sum which would end up making this particle just have a single pole doesn't exactly work, because the C parts of it, you know, you have also this. This is a different action from this. Differs by a squared. So you can have an a squared residue.
Also, the geometric series doesn't work.
Right, exactly. So you end up with a double pole a double pole proportional to a squared. And that he's working out what the impacts of that is. And so that's a similar sort of situation. So there are some subtleties you have to worry about. But in the end, I don't think that these are real problems. It's just that you have some functional form, you write it down, and you fit to it. OK. We've exhausted the audience.